Hey, everybody, it's Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message podcast. At the end of the election, no one thought would end. So this is a special episode of Off Message. We're not interviewing anyone new. I think it's too close to the election to get people to really sit down and be candid. So here are some of my favorite moments from all the interviews that we have done with politicians, their staff, entertainers, and just a lot of interesting people over the last year. For us here at Off Message, it all started on a snowy day in late January 2016 when we were summoned to the White House after a lot of negotiating and lobbying to speak with President Obama, who wanted to talk about the election. We were really kind of surprised to get that invitation. Now, let me start off by telling you the story of that day because it's kind of funny. President Obama was supposed to see me at 1:30 in the afternoon. And this was the day of the biggest snowstorm that DC had that year. We're supposed to get about 15 to 17 inches. I think we wound up getting more than 2 feet. And the snow was due to start at 3 p.m. So I'm sitting in the briefing room waiting to be summoned to the Oval Office. And an aide to Obama keeps coming in every 15 minutes and saying, 15 more minutes, 15 more minutes. Well, suffice to say, by the time I got into the Oval Office, the snow was already coming down, and I had to figure out a way to get back home in the snowstorm after interviewing the president. I had packed my family off to New Orleans, Louisiana, knowing that they would be snowed in. I live in a place that the power tends to go out when the snow comes. And so imagine this. I'm sitting across from the leader of the free world, and on one hand, I'm trying to interview the guy. On the other hand, I'm looking over his shoulder into the Rose Garden, watching the snow pile up and thinking, how the hell am I going to get home? Well, one of the real challenges with Obama is getting him off his talking points. And really, the only preparation I did for that interview that day was to talk to a lot of his aides. How do you interrupt him? I asked. Well, one of his top advisors, I won't say who, said, just go with the flow. Compliment him. The best way to interrupt him, and this person said, when I go into meetings and Obama's going on and on and on, and he goes on and on, is to just say, sir, that is what a great point. And then that puts a smile on his face and you interrupt him. Well, at the beginning of this interview, Obama was in full filibuster mode. He didn't want to say anything interesting. We were literally sitting knee to knee on the couch, and I'm thinking to myself as I'm looking at my watch, I'm going to get 40 minutes with this guy, and he's going to spend 38 minutes of it going over the talking points. So the critical moment in this interview was me saying to him, sir, you are the absolute best politician that ever ran in the state of Iowa. So Obama laughed. He let me interrupt him. And that set the scene, I think, for a really interesting interview, because this was the first time Obama had spoken expansively about his admiration for Hillary Clinton. But the most interesting thing to me, having been someone who covered the 2008 campaign with Hillary Clinton, was the sense of payback, and I mean that in sort of a positive way, that Obama had towards Clinton. And we have seen this with his indefatigable campaigning for her at the end of the 2016 race against Donald Trump. And the fact, and it was just really starting to dawn on him, I think, that she was the guarantor of his legacy. And as I've reported over the last few months, there was a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiations going on between the two camps. But this interview, in which he talks really admiringly about how difficult it was for her to run as a woman in 2008, I think, really set him on a different path and gave us, I think, some insights into the way that he really thought about Hillary Clinton.
Her strengths in terms of the ability to debate, the ability to, I think, project genuine concern in smaller groups and to interact with people where folks realize she's really warm and funny and engaging.
Do you think being Secretary of State for a while made it a little difficult in order for her to get back and transition to where she was?
Look, you're always rusty when you start going back in. Look at my first debate in 2012, right? If you haven't been doing it, you lose some of those muscles. But the other thing that I'll always remember is the sheer strength, determination, endurance, stick-to-itness, never-give-up attitude that Hillary had during those primaries. I mean, we had as competitive and lengthy and expensive and tough primary fight as there's been in modern American politics. And she had to do everything that I had to do, except like Ginger Rogers, backwards in heels. You know, she had to wake up earlier than I did because she had to get her hair done. She had to handle all the expectations that were placed on her. She had a tougher job throughout that primary than I did. She was right there the entire time. And had things gone a little bit different in some states, or if the sequence of primaries and caucuses has been a little different, she could have easily won.
By the time we ran into Jeb Bush in the darkest days of New Hampshire, he was already a spent force in the Republican Party. And frankly, that's what made him really interesting. We were invited onto Jeb Bush's bus in the parking lot of St. Anselm's College in the middle of a raging snowstorm. And he was in really no mood to talk. Brett Baer of Fox News gets off the bus right in front of us and tells me flat out he is in a hell of a bad mood. And when we walked back to sit with him, he really, really, the body language was all wrong. I didn't think we were going to be able to get anything out of him. But the truth of the matter is, Bush is a really companionable guy. And there is a lot more to him, I think, than he is able to portray on TV. He's a guy with a lot of integrity. He's a very, very smart dude. And at the moment we caught him, which was not a good moment in his life, he turned out to be in a really reflective frame of mind. And to me, the most interesting thing was, as he was getting hammered, and I mean hammered by Donald Trump, who of course referred to him as low energy and tweeted something nasty about his wife, the moment that really got Bush going was when I asked him about his brother. Take a listen.
I would say the last part of my brother's time, the part I didn't like, was that they just let the incoming come.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I got tired of that. Tired because I love my brother, and my impulse watching the news in the last 3 years where no one seemed to defend him was, get out there and fight. Hit back. These guys are wrong. And
how angry did you get when you were watching that stuff?
It bugged the crap out of me. Because I think George deserved better, and I just don't think that they, I think, I don't know, just didn't seem like there was a more robust defense of his presidency in the end, and I think you need to do that.
Can I make just an observation and tell me if I'm if I'm out of line to say it, but you know, you just banged your hand when you said that. There's a real vehemence in that defense. Do you think you have, to some extent, defended him more than you've defended yourself sometimes in this process?
I don't know. I do it because I love him, and I've always defended him. When he was president, I never was critical of anything he did, even though there were times that I thought he made the wrong decision. That's what brothers do. Well, I defend myself pretty good, but
you do. I'm not implying you don't, but I mean
that's a little too deep. Now we're getting into the psychobabble.
Well, that's
stuff.
Me. You know, I'm from Brooklyn.
So Ben Carson, really unusual presidential candidate, and we had a really unusual interview. It's really clear to me that this guy is on some intellectual plane, higher than other normal humans. He just doesn't relate to people in the way that a regular a person would relate to another person. He just seems to be floating above the room. He has this ethereal quality. And pinning him down in conversation proved to be really, really difficult until I started talking about President Obama and the issue of race, which is very, very near and dear to Carson's heart and very, very important in sort of understanding the psychology of his presidential campaign and how he interacted with a lot of the other candidates. But the question that I asked him about President Obama really set him off. He was giving really measured answers. This was at the sort of the end of his run. This was South Carolina. We were sitting in a conference room. He looked tired from a day of campaigning. The end was clearly near. But he wanted to reflect on race. And he said something to me that made some news at the time. Take a listen.
You've spoken with President Obama over the years, right? I would
presume.
No. You've never really talked with him.
Yeah, I spoke with him after the prayer breakfast, briefly on stage. That's the last time I spoke to him.
What did you guys talk about?
He just said, thank you for coming.
That was about it?
He didn't say he enjoyed the speech.
I don't think he enjoyed the speech, right? But isn't it, are you curious at all about what his experience was like? I mean, when he was elected.
Which experience?
The experience of being elected. Let's just stop it at January 20th, 2009, right? Was that significant for you? As somebody who sat and watched that, I was there, I was in the crowd, mm-hmm. right? It was a pretty interesting moment in American history, right? Did you derive any joy out of that, any sense of pride? How did you sort of feel, how did you process that?
You know, I did not. I mean, like most Americans, I was proud that we broke the color barrier when he was elected. But I also recognized that his experience and my experience are night and day different. He didn't grow up like I grew up by any stretch of
the
imagination.
That's right.
Not even close.
He is an African American as opposed to an African American.
Right? African American. He was, you know, raised white. Many of his formative years were spent in Indonesia. So for him to, you know, claim that, you know, he identifies with the experience of Black Americans, I think, is a bit of a stretch.
So David Plouffe, who is the 2008 campaign manager for Barack Obama and an informal advisor to Hillary Clinton in 2016, is, from my experience, the smartest person I have ever met in Democratic politics. And along with Ed Gillespie, kind of the Republican mastermind of a lot of the stuff that went on in W's presidency, I think the smartest political operative out there. This is a guy who understood data early on, understood a theory of the case. And let's face it, he's one of the two or three people who elected the first Black president of the United States, and that's not nothing. But the really fascinating part about Plouffe to me is his conversion to Hillary Clinton. David Plouffe was one of the last holdouts, and people really, really forget this now. The last holdouts in the Obama 2008 campaign that was bitterly, bitterly, bitterly set on essentially wiping Hillary Clinton and her staff off the face of the earth. Plouffe is a hyper-competitive guy. He looks like a shortstop in baseball, like an undersized shortstop in baseball. This guy just wants to beat whoever it is that he's competing against. And it took him a really, really long time to turn away from his hostility towards the Clintons based on the 2008 campaign and campaign for Hillary. But characteristically, by the time I caught up with him in the spring of 2016, when Hillary was getting really hammered by Bernie Sanders, and it really looked for a moment here like she was going to potentially lose, Plouffe took that same vigor and vinegar and energy and applied it towards Hillary Clinton. And I think the chronicles of 2016 are going to show, and I've written a lot about this, but I think other people are going to write it too, that Plouffe played a really significant behind-the-scenes role in keeping Clinton from freaking out during this campaign. And if you listen to this conversation that I had with him, you'll understand how he was, both on the inside and the outside of the campaign, trying to keep everybody calm. Take a listen.
Yeah, I think you build your team and you stick by your team and you run. I mean, listen, so I will tell you, in 08, we were the neophyte. We didn't have a lot of political barnacles. So we were pretty much able to run the campaign we wanted right. to run. And we had plenty of doubters in the Democratic Party, many, who thought trying to win states like Virginia and Indiana and Florida was crazy. But we were able to do our own thing. It was harder in 12 because you become more of the establishment. So it's got to be very hard for the Clintons. They've been on the scene for decades.
Right.
So anytime things go wrong, they have dozens of people you know, in their mail, in their email box and probably calling, saying, told you so, you got to do this, you got to do this. And one of the tests for her is, so they had a moment of trial now after yep. New Hampshire. You know, I'm sure there'll be another one in the primary, maybe not. There'll be many in the general. You're going to have your valleys.
Right.
And that's always a test. And if the thing you do is so internal tension and allow voices from the outside to really, I think, affect the campaign in a negative way, you may not win. I mean, running for president is one of the hardest things in the world, if not the hardest. You're going to be tested in ways you can see and not see. And, you know, every day is not going to be a good day. In fact, many of them are going to be horrific. And you're going to think you can't even get out of your own way. But you got to stick with your team and you got to stick to the strategy.
What can I say about Al Sharpton? He is a huge figure from my youth growing up in Brooklyn. Really divisive guy. And now about literally physically half the person that he used to be. Seeing him in person after covering him as a tabloid reporter in New York when he was this big guy wearing the tracksuits is still jarring. But I have to say, my interview with Sharpton up in his tiny little office at 30 Rock after one of his MSNBC shows was one of the highlights of 2016. Nobody, as it turned out, that I spoke to for the entire year, with the possible exception of Roger Stone, understood the psychology of Donald Trump better than Al Sharpton, who was also this fellow Bonfire of the Vanities type character. Sharpton, a kid from Brooklyn, who kind of came up in a hard scrabble kind of way, intuitively understands the outer borough psychology of Donald Trump. And his story, one of the best stories we heard on the podcast all year about traveling in a helicopter, sitting between Donald Trump and Don King in the early 90s, is just absolutely priceless. Take a listen.
I've said it before, I say it again, the bombast. If the best way I could describe Donald Trump to friends is to say if Don King had been born white, he'd been Donald Trump. Both of them are great self-promoters and great at just continuing the talk, even if you're not talking back at him.
But you want that, but that would necessitate Trump moving that hair up front.
Yeah, well, that's true. But he has a unique hairstyle. I think at the end of the day.
So Trump became. Have you said that to a lot of folks?
What?
Because it's a brilliant comparison. I mean, they really are.
I said it to one other reporter, but it didn't get much traction, so you can use
that. That is an incredible.
That's who they are. And the reason
and
I say
them,
that.
You actually like them both.
Don King introduced me to Donald Trump. When Donald Trump got.
Yeah, tell me that story.
When Donald Trump began opening hotels in Atlantic City. He wanted to get, first he had to deal with the fact that much of the city council there was black.
Right.
And that he had to deal with, he wanted to get boxing in. Mike Tyson was a hot sensation.
That's right.
Don King and Tyson was working with me on when I was painting crack houses, closing crack houses. Don King said, you need to make peace with Al Sharpton because I had marched on Trump about the ads he had ran against the Central Park Five, which I ended up being right about.
Wow.
That they were not the guys that raped the Central Park rape victim. And so Donald Trump said, yeah, he's a businessman. So Don King had me fly with him and Trump to Atlantic City in Trump's helicopter. And it was one of the most memorable things in my life to sit on a helicopter, big black Trump helicopter, with Don King and Donald Trump, both of them talking nonstop, not listening to each other. And I'm sitting there. It was probably the longest plane ride. It was a helicopter ride I ever was on.
Well, some people would say it took both of them to shut you up, right?
It took both of them to shut. I haven't been quiet since.
So Roger Stone knows Donald Trump even longer and a lot better than Al Sharpton did. Before I talk about my interview with Stone, which is fascinating, he's just, you know, he's really a character. He's either a Bond villain or an Arrested Development character. I can't figure out which. And he'll hate me saying that. Let's talk about my efforts to get Donald Trump onto this thing and how close we came over the months. I must have sent 20 emails to senior Trump advisors pitching various ways to get the guy onto the show. And we came really close a couple of times. The main thing I really wanted to talk with him early on, and this was before, by the way, things got really, really dark. what I wanted to talk with him about, I'm still fascinated by, and I haven't really heard him talk about this, was how he developed his shtick. How he developed this unbelievably distinctive speaking style at these rallies, which, and the rallies, by the way, as we head into the last week, are the thing that he does, right? I thought that he sounded a lot like Jackie Mason, when I first heard him. Like, he's got these Jewish inflections. He sounds almost like, actually not Jackie Mason, I'd say Mort Saul, who was this comedian in the 1960s who did observational humor. He used to walk around with a rolled up newspaper, would talk about stuff that he had just read in the paper. Well, Trump does that, you know, from sort of a Genghis Khan perspective. In the absence of Trump, we got a couple of folks who were close to him over the months. And the one, obviously, who was the most interesting was Roger, who is a former Nixon acolyte. And he liked all the parts of Nixon that you're not supposed to like, the dirty tricks, the paranoia. He has infamously, a tattoo of Nixon on his back. But the thing that I found about Roger, and I think we found as we were interviewing all these quote-unquote types throughout the year, is that underneath it all, he was just kind of an interesting guy. And the underappreciated part of Roger Stone is, and this is, by the way, a guy who's pretty vicious, I should say. I can't really sugarcoat a lot of the things that he says, particularly about the Clintons. He's written books about the Clintons. He claimed to sort of have a back channel, the WikiLeaks folks. So I don't want to understate the extent to which Stone is a provocateur and a pretty nasty one at that. But in general, the part of him that fascinated me was the more conventional Roger Stone. The fact that he was really, I think, throughout the course of the campaign, one of the steadiest and most sensible advisors in terms of domesticating Trump. And I do believe that if Trump, and by no means was Roger the only one who was advising this stuff, but if Trump had really followed a more conventional path laid out by Stone, I think he would have done a lot better. But again, the thing I found most interesting about Stone was talking about the psychology of Trump. And remember, at the time we interviewed him in the middle of the primaries, people really were still grappling with this. And one of the most interesting parts of this interview was him talking about just how difficult it was to get Trump's attention. And listen to this passage where he sort of talks about briefing him.
Trump is Trump. I mean, he's an entirely unique, self-styled individual.
Does he ever piss you off? You have a very strong personality. You clearly have a strategic imperative. Are there times where you're sitting across from the guy and you're like, shut up and listen to what I have to tell you?
No, because you can't deal with him on that basis. It's just not, you know, when you know somebody that long, you get an understanding about how to affect their thinking without being, you know, without being insulting or overstepping a line. Remember that he's not a political figure until recently. Right. So the dynamics of your whole relationship are different. Conversations with him are light. They're not heavy. He's very engaging. He's very funny. He's fun to be with. He's fun to work for. It's an adventure.
How do you get him on your brainwave? How do you persuade Donald Trump, which I presume you've had to do from time to time? It seems he's moving in your direction now. What is the technique of sort of getting Trump around to your way of thinking?
Nobody puts words in Donald's mouth. He is his own conceptualizer. All you can do is present information and let him either assimilate it or not. When you write something for him, keep it short and staccato. He's not going to read a 40-page white paper on the economy. Zero chance of that. It's just too boring. Don't blame him. I don't like it either. So keep it simple and direct, because that's the way he communicates.
Hillary Clinton does not like the press. That's not a newsflash. She does not like to sit in an unstructured environment in front of a microphone for a long period of time. So I was a little bit surprised after months of lobbying when her staff offered a podcast to us up in Syracuse when she was on the road campaigning during the New York primary in April. Not a lot of lead into this. I'd covered her quite a bit really since 2004 and 2005, but hadn't really sat down and talked with her since her glass ceiling speech, really. So I was interested in seeing how she changed over the years. First thing that struck me is she hadn't changed much over the years. When I ran into her a couple of times in Iowa during the caucuses, I had rope lined her, and she knows what I look like. You know, I am the dude in the hat. And she looked right through me. She has this amazing capacity when she does not want to communicate to really look through you as if you are a pane of glass. It is a disconcerting experience to lock eyes with somebody you know and somebody who knows you, and they are somehow pretending not to see you, it is creepy. So when you sit down with her, and this is, and I think this is kind of the duality that America is grappling with Hillary Clinton. When you sit down with her and start to actually have a conversation, it's as if none of that other stuff had happened. It is as if we had picked up where we were 7 or 8 years ago. We were talking in a free-flowing way. She answered my questions really candidly. And to me, the most interesting part was sort of the most trivial part, where we kind of breaking the ice. I'm a terrible flyer. She is not a terrible flyer. We went through a lot of hairy flights with her in all kinds of weather, and she would always like sleep through it. So listen to this. Her answer about how she deals with hazardous plane travel says a lot about who she is as a person, and a lot about the resiliency she has shown as a candidate.
The one thing I will tell you I remember very distinctly about 2007 and 2008 were your airplane, with the airplane trips I took with you. I was not a happy flyer, and nothing ever seemed to bother you. I mean, we were in some really hairy situations, and you would sleep your way through it.
Right. That is the answer to everything. When you're facing a difficult issue that you absolutely can do nothing about, in this case, right, I can't fly the plane, I can't change the weather, falling asleep, you'll either wake up and things will be fine or you won't.
Wow. I didn't expect you to get existential this quickly.
Well, but flying on an airplane, the whole thing makes no sense to me. Does it make sense to you?
No, not at all.
I mean, how it works, how the whole, you know, science of it, you know, aerodynamics, you know, actually manages to keep us afloat. I'm constantly amazed.
Were you ever nervous on a flight?
I wasn't by the time you and I were flying around together. Early on, back in Arkansas, we would fly on anything. I mean, right. I flew on crop dusters. I flew on planes that were so small, they were just two-seaters, and you felt like you were putting right on a pair of pants. So I've been on planes where doors have flown off. I've been on planes where you land in a field. I've had some adventures some decades ago that I think set me up for just knowing that once I put myself on the plane, I was just going to have to take a deep breath and hopefully enjoy it.
But really, you're not joking. That is a philosophy about just
right
sort of putting that out of your mind and going.
I find that very true for a lot of life. I really do.
Most of you out there in podcast land do not know who Jeff Rowe is. But this interview that I did with him, which is, I think, the longest one we did, close to an hour and a half, I have gotten the most positive feedback and a lot of emails from listeners telling me that this was their favorite. And here's why. Rowe is sort of the brains behind the Ted Cruz campaign. Now, Jeff isn't going to like me saying this, but I just actually saw a Saturday Night Live skit from last year about Cruz. And the gist of it is basically right. He is unlikable. People do not have an initially warm and fuzzy feeling about him. He is not a loosey-goosey candidate. He does not have the most limber sense of humor. He is, in total, a difficult product for a political professional to sell. Jeff Rowe is that political professional, and Jeff Rowe nearly sold this guy into a very strong position in the 2016 primaries. They won some very critical states. The thing that makes Jeff Rowe special, and the reason why people are still emailing me about this interview months and months later, is how good an explainer the guy is. You know, this is a really complicated business politics, and a lot of the stuff that you read in the paper has nothing to do with the mechanical day-to-day running of a campaign. And Rowe has this unique ability to sort of lay it out for you in layman's terms. And in particular, he talked about the challenges of running against Donald Trump, who was able to get all of this free media, and how a campaign like Cruz attempted, ultimately failed, to adjust to that. So to me, the highlight of the interview, but I really think y'all should listen to the whole thing, is how Rowe talks about Cruz's victory in Iowa, how they used really sophisticated targeting techniques to get 10,000 votes that ultimately delivered the election to them. Now, a lot of people think they did a couple of dirty tricks with Ben Carson. Rowe denied that. But it's the mechanics of it, using the technology, using data stored in the cloud that delivered Iowa to Ted Cruz and very nearly made him the only candidate to really challenge Donald Trump.
Romney had 2 voter segments and Obama had 9. 9.
Explain to people what voter segments are.
So voter segments are, instead of saying that what we used to do in micro-targeting, that if you're redheaded and left-handed and live in a cul-de-sac and have a, you know, VFW and a subscription to Pets Monthly, that you believe this. But it's all anonymized.
But these are 9 factors as opposed to 2 factors.
But no, this is 9 segments of people on what they believe, right, and how they receive the information to help them.
Which gives you a level of granularity exponentially greater than you had before.
Because we're running literally billions of codes on this. So he had 9. Greg Abbott has a Republican world record. He did 8 in his election against Wendy Davis.
Right.
We did 176 in Iowa.
Wow.
We did 1,809 through the course of the campaign.
Wow.
So you'd be sitting there, if you're, we don't need to know, it used to be that you would do a poll, call 400 people, which is a joke. That could we, like,
yeah,
that's a joke that you can call 400 people and say that one issue works 62% with 62% and another issue works 58%. And let's run with the issue at 62%. After you run, even after they run regression analysis, which is rarely even done,
right.
That is such a, when you can actually know the names of the people. We knew we had 9,100, I mean, these things are kind of stapled to my heart,
yeah,
it has been, 9,181 people choosing between us and Donald Trump in Iowa. We knew their names and what they cared about and how they received their information.
That's amazing.
That's amazing. That's never, that's just,
what'd you do? What do you do with that information?
Well, some would speculate, depending on how the election turns out. You know, what a hell of a place to start if he considers looking at this again.
And now for Ted Cruz. We were really surprised Cruz said yes to us, frankly. He talked to us on the eve of the Republican convention. And the big question at this point was whether he was going to endorse Donald Trump. And for anyone who listened to this interview, which took place, by the way, in the common area of Cruz's Washington, D.C. condo as his wife was making dinner. You can't get much better than that. This interview really left very little doubt about what was about to happen. And of course, what happened was Cruz got up there and said Republicans should vote their conscience. And he and his wife were essentially booed out of the arena. He would flip-flop later and support Trump to the chagrin of many supporters, and I am told some of his own people. But at this moment, he was really the sole reed standing in the wind against the Trump movement. And a little funny postscript to this. I ran this podcast, and then I go to the convention in Cleveland. I see this spectacle with Cruz. I file my story. I walk over, I think it was to the Marriott Hotel, just to get an Uber, just have an address to send an Uber to so that I can go back to my hotel after Cruz's speech. And lo and behold, I'm standing there, and what should pull up right in front of me? But this massive SUV, 2 guards get out, they open the door, and who should step out but Heidi and Ted Cruz. So I'm standing face to face with Ted Cruz a couple of days after I interviewed him on the biggest night of his political life, and he walks up to me. I was just totally stunned. He walks up to me, shakes my hand, and says to me, "How'd I do?" And I said to him, and I will use this language, so I'm going to warn you now. I said, "Well, Senator, I don't know how you did long term, but it took a lot of balls." And he shook my hand, and he just sort of, in that very Ted Cruz kind of way, bobbed his head back and forth, and he said, "Glenn, it's not hard when you're acting on your own conscience." And then, of course, a couple of months later, he's endorsing, or at least saying he's going to vote for Donald Trump. Politics, ladies and gentlemen. Well, anyway, it was a great interview. The guy understands the business of politics. And even after we turned off the tape recorder, we just kibitzed for, I guess, another 45 minutes. But here's Ted Cruz, always fun to talk with.
Right, but is the Republican Party right now in a particularly difficult moment? Do you think history is going to go back and look at this election as a moment, as a crucible moment for your party?
I think the country is in a difficult moment. And at the end of the day, I care a heck of a lot more about America than I do about any political party. If the Republican Party stands for individual liberty, if we defend the Bill of Rights, if we stand for keeping this country safe, then we deserve to win. And if we don't, we deserve to lose. It shouldn't be it's not just a game of blue team, red team. It is actually about making a difference in people's lives.
And really, because this is a good way to end, because you're not going to want to answer this, but does your party's candidate right now represent that kind of equity that you have just described? Or you have not made up your mind yet?
That's going to be a decision every voter has to make.
And you have not made that decision.
I am watching and listening along with millions of Americans, and we desperately need change.
So let's finish with Ann Coulter, kind of an interesting bookend with President Obama. I have never received more hate mail on any guest than I did with Ann Coulter. A lot of people thought, quote unquote, I was normalizing hatred. She's a big Donald Trump supporter. She said she believed that his proposed Muslim ban was a personal birthday gift to herself. And she supports his wall proposal. And folks are like, well, why are you talking to this person? And the reason I am talking to this person is because Ann Coulter apparently represents the view of a substantial minority of United States Americans. And she has a hell of a way of expressing herself. And just as with Roger Stone or with Al Sharpton, I found her to be a delightful conversationalist. And the other thing that really drew me to her was I hate bullies. I hate people picking on other people. I despise situations where a large group of folks are ganging up on any one person. And I was really struck by Coulter's appearance on one of the Comedy Central roasts, where pretty much everybody in the room went after her in like an incredibly personal way, making fun of her physical appearance. And I thought that took a lot of guts. I mean, she's obviously said a lot of crazy stuff, stuff I don't believe in. And in the course of this interview, you will hear me interrupting her a lot, saying, well, that's not true. But in general, she's a charming conversationalist, and she has her point of view, and she has a right to express it. And I think that is a pretty good way to end the 2016 experience. And that is, let's listen to people we don't agree with. Let's interject fact. Let's put context on the things that they say. But I think right now, more than any other time, and I've been up on the soapbox a couple of times on the podcast, right now is a really, really good time for us to talk with people we don't agree with. Here's Ann Coulter.
So you're going into that situation, and you know, come on, there's got to be a daredevil aspect. You're going into that. You know there's not a single person in that room is going to cut you an inch of slack. What is that? I just want to get into your biochemistry.
Glenn, have you seen my entire career?
Yes, I have.
This is what my life is.
But I want you to describe to the listeners what... what is the biochemistry of that? Like, what does it feel like to go into a room where you know you're going to get that?
I didn't get the gene that makes me care about what other people think. I'm much like Trump that way. I don't really care. They're just words. I'm of the sticks and stones school. And I never would have thought what we want is a reality TV star. I don't think anybody did. But the reason people support him isn't because he's a reality TV star. It is his issues. And no one else would raise those issues. But the things that I used to think were disadvantages, I now realize, oh my gosh, that's a fantastic advantage, including being a reality TV star, being comfortable in front of an audience, in front of a mic, speaking, the fact that he grew up on construction sites, and that's why he talks like that. I mean, normally, people like me don't like when spokesmen use bad grammar. It drives me crazy about Republicans. But I kind of like it with him because he speaks in a way that has far broader appeal than the way I speak.
Okay, but isn't this a case of being in love? I mean,
oh yes.
Isn't this a case of eliding deficits because you are starry-eyed about this guy?
Yes, I worship him like the North Koreans worship the dear leader. Yes, I would die for him, Glenn.